You're listening to the North Carolina Reading Service, broadcasting from Raleigh, North Carolina, serving the blind and print-impaired community since 1983. This is Nancy Jones. For the next hour, I will be reading to you from Vanity Fair magazine. This is Vanity Fair, Part A. The Fog of War. How can we trust the images we see from the Israel-Hamas conflict? By Fred Richin. Opening photo, a Tel Aviv installation in November displays images of hostages abducted by Hamas. For those of us on the outside, the fog of war is beginning to resemble a total eclipse of the sun. With the contraction of print publications, the front pages of newspapers and the covers of news magazines have essentially disappeared, no longer providing a unifying focus. With a multitude of factions weaponizing media, using fake or misleading imagery in a parallel media war, viewers have been left largely in the dark, not knowing with whom to empathize, their tribal loyalties reinforced. And now, with mounting skepticism fueled by such manipulations, the photographs and videos that actually depict the conflict between Hamas and Israel are increasingly considered suspect. As a result, the BBC can publish an article on how 2 4-year-old boys, Omer and Omar, one Israeli and one Palestinian, were both killed in the early days of the war, their deaths exploited in a social media battle. Some have argued that it is not Omar who has been depicted, but a doll. Others, that Omer and his sisters did not die, but are crisis actors. Omar's mother, who confirmed to the BBC that her son had been killed by an airstrike, has been forced to protect her child's memory from this grotesque accusation. They have no right to say he is a doll. A friend of Omer's family, all 5 of whom were reportedly massacred, told the BBC to deal with their death is hard enough, and all these comments make it even worse. Previously, the photographs of children brutalized by adults became icons that served as pleas for the violence to stop. Such was the case with the horrific images of 14-year-old Emmett Till, a black child beaten and lynched in 1955 by racists in Mississippi. When his mother allowed pictures of young Emmett's body to be shared with the press, public reaction helped spark the civil rights movement. Viewers responded with outrage as well to the photo of 9-year-old Kim Phuc Phan Thi, her body burning from napalm, dropped by a South Vietnamese plane in 1972. Of Hector Peterson, age 12, killed in 1976 by South African police in a peaceful protest during the apartheid era. And of Alan Kurdi, age 3, lying face down on the beach, having drowned as his family tried to escape from Syria in 2015. There was empathy for these children, their tragic fates mourned, not belittled or dismissed. Today, while many people who post imagery on social media are credible and responsible, providing insider perspectives and expert insights, there are also legions of rogue online fabricators. Now, as Vaibhav Vats reports from India for The Atlantic, a grim video of a beheading by a Mexican drug cartel was shared as an attack on Israeli citizens. A 2014 video of the Islamic State destroying a mosque in Syria was labeled as the Israeli bombings of a Palestinian mosque. Why? Vats explains, the disinformation machinery of the Hindu right has been operating in an amoral zone, treating the Israel-Hamas war as little more than an entertaining spectacle happening somewhere far away and as a windfall for its Islamophobic agenda. The recent emergence of AI-generated media runs the risk of making people wary even of genuine imagery. As Hani Farid, a UC Berkeley specialist in disinformation, told the New York Times, the specter of deepfakes is much, much more significant now. It just takes a few, and then you poison the well and everything becomes suspect. People then accuse media outlets and those in power, the article suggests, of brazenly trying to manipulate public opinion by creating AI content, even when the content is almost certainly genuine. Or such fabrications can be used for things that should have happened but did not. The Instagram account Happy Children of Palestine is intended as a commentary on the difficulties many Palestinian children endure by creating synthetic images of non-existent children. Smiling and laughing in a bakery, drinking water, or playing on a playground. The account argues that this artwork, though born from artificial intelligence, reflects a harsh truth. A reminder that without peace, the playgrounds lie silent, the swings unmoving, and the hopeful eyes of the young are forced to witness scenes of a script written by the hands of conflict and adversity. Next photo. At a Ramallah West Bank rally in support of Gaza in November, people hold photos of Palestinians in Israeli jails. In this chaos of images, it is more and more difficult for the documentation of actual events by professional visual journalists to emerge and be trusted. Often, photojournalists and videographers are thrown into conflicts without the ability to explore their context and ramifications. And chronicling the conflict comes with a heavy toll. In the first month of the war between Hamas and Israel, 39 journalists and media workers were killed, according to the Committee to Protect Journalists. As representatives of the foreign press, such correspondents provide coverage that may also be judged by insiders as incomplete and biased, as well as criticized by outsiders as insufficiently supportive of their own preconceptions. The public square of ideas to which these visual journalists used to powerfully contribute now lies largely dormant. Part of the problem is that until breaking news erupts, many regions of the world are left unexamined. For decades, little attempt has been made, for example, to understand the daily lives of Palestinians in Gaza outside of the outbreaks of violence. Who are the teachers, the doctors, the poets, the parents, and the children who live there? What are their hopes and dreams? Without such background, all Gazans can be perceived as monochromatic, synonymous with Hamas, making false, invented narratives easier to foist on a public who have had little with which to compare them. Similarly, why have the ambitions of Jewish settlers on the West Bank been allowed to dominate the news over the years, while the work of Israeli peace activists, including some who were casualties of the initial Hamas onslaught, been left almost entirely unexplored? Are their goals any less valid? Widely published photo essays, in the heyday of picture magazines, used to help transcend such reactive coverage by offering nuance and complexity. Without such context, conflicts and up-looking like incomprehensible variations of one another, spectacles of violence and destruction. What can be done to restore a sense of the actual? Organizations are now working on systems to watermark images or to establish where and when they were first made and whether they were digitally modified. None of these systems are likely to be foolproof, nor will they somehow miraculously restore the trust of viewers. According to a recent Knight Foundation and Gallup survey, half of Americans already believe that most national news organizations intend to mislead, misinform, or persuade the public. But one partial solution involves regarding photographers in a manner similar to how writers are viewed, as authors responsible for the integrity of their own work. As the former picture editor of the New York Times Magazine and a longtime champion of the authenticity of visual reportage, I have been involved in an effort, along with representatives of organizations including World Press Photo, Magnum Photos, and the National Press Photographers Association, to try to reclaim photojournalism's original mission. In response to the abundance of manipulated and synthetic images online, we recently launched a website, Writing with Light, and our statement of principles begins, as recordings of the visible, journalistic photographs must be fair and accurate representations of what the photographer witnessed. While our initiative will not suddenly illuminate the fog, it may provide some coherence and needed light. Even so, as I finish writing this, 50 years to the day that I began my first job in media, I am still left feeling aghast. Who killed Jerzy Kosinski? In a golden era of literary fame, Jerzy Kosinski was celebrated everywhere from Elaine's to the Oscars. Then an article hyping rumors that the Polish-born anti-communist didn't write his own books set off a chain reaction that torched his reputation. 3 decades after Kosinski's untimely death at 57, Wayne Lawson, who worked closely with him, reveals the complicated truth about the novelist and his tragic fall. Opening photos, Team Jerzy. Jerzy Kosinski with his longtime companion Kiki von Fraunhofer in 1982. One article described her as his business manager, his secretary typist, proofreader, housekeeper, traveling companion, fellow polo player, and skier. They married in 1987. And a 1976 portrait of Kosinski by Sophie Basoules. 1. For a week in 1980 and 5 months in 1981, I worked for the controversial Polish-American novelist Jerzy Kosinski. He wasn't controversial then. Brilliant, charismatic, fawned on by New York's upper crust, he was, at 47, at the peak of his storybook Ascent. His third novel, Being There, had just been made into an award-winning film starring Peter Sellers, and Warren Beatty had cast him to play a major role in Reds. No one could have foreseen the nightmare that lay just ahead for him. He called me on November 28, 1980, to ask if I would read the final galleys of his latest book. I didn't know him or his work. So I said if the book was in final galleys, I would suggest leaving it alone. I can't, he said, in a high-pitched voice with a strong Slavic accent. It came out 7 years ago, but I was never satisfied with it. It's a very personal story, so I've got to get it right this time. I promise it will only take you a few days. He sounded so likable that I yielded. How about if I spend an hour or two looking at a couple of the galleys and tell you what I think? Perfect, he said. Can you come to my apartment tomorrow? The apartment was high up in a building at the corner of 6th Avenue and 57th Street. A tall, auburn-haired woman answered the door and introduced herself as Kiki von Fraunhofer. Come in, called Kosinski from the room behind her. Thin and wiry, with piercing eyes, a nose like an eagle's beak, and a mass of black curls, he had star quality. He was standing in front of a large window beside a table with a stack of galleys on it. After hurried introductions, he said, "You'll sit here, if that's okay. Kiki works there," he continued, pointing to a table with a typewriter on it in the kitchen area. "I work back there," he added, gesturing in the opposite direction. "Kiki will get you anything you need." I was struck by the modesty of the place. One large room furnished with 2 brown tufted leather couches, a coffee table between them, and a couple of straight-backed chairs. To one side, a small kitchen. To the other, a bedroom, alcove, and a bathroom. The galleys were anything but final, sprinkled with a sort of errors made by writers whose first language is not English. I assumed, correctly, that Kosinski had read the previous galleys and introduced mistakes. I could also tell, however, that he was highly intelligent and totally original, and his spoken English was smooth and fluent. After 2 hours, von Fraunhofer took my marked galleys to Kosinski. Minutes later, he swept in, beaming. He said my changes were just what he had hoped for, and would I please, please come back and finish the job. The novel was called The Devil Tree. Kosinski wore pajamas when he worked. At 11:30 a.m., we ordered sandwiches and salads from Wolf's Delicatessen across the street, and he joined von Fraunhofer and me for lunch at my table. He was a wonderful, witty raconteur. I soon learned his astounding history, at least his version of it. Born Josef Luenkopf to well-off Jewish parents in Lodz, Poland, in 1933, he would almost certainly not have survived the Holocaust if his father had not changed the family's name and farmed out his 6-year-old son to peasants in the countryside for safekeeping. In their care, the boy was cruelly mistreated, once so traumatically that he lost the power of speech for 6 years. reunited with his family after the war, he earned two MA degrees from the University of Lodz and taught at the Polish Academy of Sciences. He also studied in the Soviet Union. He spoke Russian and German and served in the Polish Army Reserve. In 1957, he managed to immigrate to America, where he taught himself English, worked on a PhD at Columbia University, and received grants from the Guggenheim Fellowship and the Ford Foundation. He then taught popular courses at Wesleyan, Princeton, and Yale. Under the pseudonym Joseph Novak, he published two very critical books about life under communism, The Future is Ours, Comrade, 1960, and No Third Path, 1962. In 1962, he married Mary Weir, the widow of a Pittsburgh steel tycoon, who was older than he, and who, as long as she lived, had the benefit of her late husband's fortune. With her, Kosinski enjoyed great luxury, a yacht, expensive cars, grand tours, multiple residences. He also became an American citizen and published his first novel, The Painted Bird, a fictionalized account of his tortured childhood, which won him international praise, except in Poland, where his books were banned. Weir died in 1968, by which time Kosinski had begun his relationship with Katharina Kiki von Fraunhofer, who came from an aristocratic Bavarian family. During their time together, he had produced six more novels, most of them dedicated to her. The first of these, Steps, 1968, won the National Book Award. Kosinski's screenplay for the second, Being There, 1971, won the top award from the Writers Guild of America and the British Academy of Film and Television Arts. The film won a Best Supporting Actor Oscar for Melvin Douglas in 1980, and Kosinski was a presenter at the Oscars in 1982. The original The Devil Tree, 1973, was followed by three less successful works, all containing people and incidents drawn from Kosinski's life, and more heavily laced with explicit sex scenes. Cockpit, 1975, Blind Date, 1977, and Passion Play, 1979. By then, world sales of his books were in the millions, and from 1973 to 1975, he was president of the American branch of PEN, the International Writers Association. He came along at a propitious moment in time, when a crop of colorful New York writers started to be treated as celebrities in the media. Elaine's, a restaurant on the Upper East Side, owned and managed by Elaine Kaufman, became the favorite gathering place of these writers, who sat shoulder to shoulder at their special tables. Norman Mailer, Mario Puzo, Kurt Vonnegut, Gay Talese, and Tom Wolfe, to name a few. Even alongside those stars, Kosinski seemed special. He was a frequent guest on TV of Johnny Carson and Dick Cavett, and the life of the party, with such exalted friends as Henry Kissinger, Zbigniew Brzezinski, Oscar de la Renta, Diana Vreeland, Mike Wallace, Tony Bennett, and Ahmet Erdogan. Known for his playful stunts, he was apt to arrive at social events disguised with a wig or a false mustache, and he liked to find a hiding place and disappear for hours. He and I connected nicely. We were almost the same age, and I enjoyed working with him, always knowing that he would have the last word. Once I got him to add a paragraph to the text, suggesting that he might spell out more clearly the moment his rich young hero decides to cast off his powerful advisors. That night, Kosinski phoned me to say he was taking my advice. He had written a connecting paragraph, which he read to me. It appears late in the book and begins, "Soon after that, Wayland was sure that the time had come for him to forge his own covenant." When we finished the edit, he said he would be starting the next novel soon and hoped I would be available. 2. The new novel, Pinball, has two heroes, the country's top rock star who conceals his identity, and an older musician who sets out to unmask him. We worked from 9 to 5, Monday through Friday. Kwasinski composed in the bedroom and von Fraunhofer retyped a few pages at a time. I edited the text, and she returned it to Kwasinski, who kept what he wanted. Each page came back to me at least two or three times. One day, Kwasinski pointed to a sentence I had altered and said, "You don't want to change this. It's a wordplay." Turning words around on themselves was his Achilles heel. I told him wordplay has to make sense or it doesn't work. But showing off his English had obviously become a feature of his social discourse. I could just hear Kissinger or Vreeland complimenting him on how deft he was at it. In this case, he accepted my edit, but I could never stop him from trying to overstretch the language. An example from Passion Play. A character says of illegal Haitian immigrants, "Remember, only a week ago they were starving in Port-au-Prince." A second character then says to the hero, "Now you could be the prince of their port." We finished on October 17th, 5 months after we started, a record for him. At some point, he began presenting me with his novels, all playfully inscribed, until I had the entire set. As I was leaving one evening, von Fraunhofer told me Kwasinski would like to hire me on a permanent basis. They planned to spend several coming months in Europe, she said, and I would, of course, travel with them. By then, however, I had had several interviews for a job at the New York Times Book Review. When Kwasinski heard that, he told me, Abe Rosenthal, the executive editor of the paper, and Arthur Gelb, then the deputy managing editor, are great friends of mine. Do you mind if I call them and recommend you? Do you mind if I call them and recommend you? Next photos, book club. As his star rose, Kwasinski was everywhere. On Late Night with David Letterman, 1982. On the cover of his novel, The Painted Bird, with actor Tammy Grimes, 1986. Addressing the Holocaust Survivors Memorial Foundation, 1982. With Jill Krementz and Kurt Vonnegut at the DNC, 1980. On the set of Being There, 1979. Three. When I started at the Book Review on October 19th, 1981, I had no inkling that Kwasinski was under ongoing attacks in the Polish press, with claims that his books in English had been written in Polish and translated by others without credit, and that he had stolen the photos of The Painted Bird and Being There from Polish writers. On my second or third day, Arthur Gelb phoned me. He said his wife was writing a cover story on Kwasinski for the Times magazine. Could she call me? Minutes later, I was on the phone with Barbara Gelb, who basically wanted to be assured of just one thing, that Kwasinski did not need any serious help with his writing. I had to disabuse her by saying that he required the kind of help most second-language writers require. Her lengthy article, Being Jerzy Kwasinski, with a cover photo by Annie Leibovitz of the novelist in polo jodhpurs, stripped to the waist, appeared on February 21, 1982. It was a pure puff piece, pegged to the publication date of Pinball. Gelb briefly describes Kwasinski's writing process. He knows precisely how to use his time. So many weeks allotted to the writing, the typing, the editing, the correction of galley proofs, the promotion tour. She leaves the rest to von Fraunhofer. And the woman who mothers him also acts as his business manager, his secretary, typist, proofreader, housekeeper, traveling companion. He is always on the go and claims he can ride anywhere. Fellow polo player and skier. No mention of hired help. Next photos. Kwasinski with Wayne Lawson and Elizabeth Biondi at Vanity Fair's offices, 1985. With Warren Beatty, circa 1981, with Inge Morath and Arthur and Rebecca Miller, 1969, back at Being There, 1979, on the cover of the New York Times Magazine, shot by Annie Leibovitz, 1982. Gelb touched lightly on Kozinski's critics. John Leonard, who has reviewed some of Kozinski's novels for The Times, sometimes not unfavorably, has expressed qualms about Kozinski's sexual stance. When he learns in his fiction to respect women, Leonard wrote sternly in his review of Blind Date, he will be a fine novelist. If that was Kozinski's treatment at The Times magazine, however, there was an entirely different one in store at The Times Book Review. Each week, the editors met to determine which books should be reviewed. At one early meeting I attended, Harvey Shapiro, the editor-in-chief of the book review, called on Robert Asahina, one of the young editors. What books did he want to bring up? Asahina said he had looked at Kozinski's new novel and would strongly suggest that we pass on it. Shapiro turned to me, "Isn't that the one you worked on? What do you think?" I said I had a personal stake in it. Nevertheless, I thought it would be a mistake not to review a Kozinski novel. Professors all over the country taught his books, and he had an enormous international audience. On February 25th, the Daily Paper ran a review by Christopher Lehman Haupt, which began, "Judging from Jerzy Kozinski's eighth novel, Pinball, one has to conclude that the author's long affair with the English language is not going well. It isn't just the ineptness of some of the book's lines. Still hiding his now limpid flesh," Mr. Kozinski writes, presumably intending limp. Not transparent, because he is describing a man who has just suffered a loss of arousal. "I had no recollection of limpid in the manuscript, but if the critic had only known to look, he would have found it correctly used on page 197 of Passion Play, Kozinski's previous novel. A privileged intimacy as limpid and inevitable as a forest brook." Lehman Haupt drove on, "Lacking a sense of the language, and thus lacking any style of his own, the author gropes for any passable cliché." Kozinski and I had not stayed in touch after I stopped working for him, but I could imagine how this review must have stung, coming from the same paper in which, in 1968, the critic Hugh Kenner had written about Steps. Celine and Kafka stand behind this accomplished art. 4. Richard Locke, the deputy editor of the Times Book Review, interviewed me for my job, but before I started, he had gone to Condé Nast to edit the soon-to-be-relaunched Vanity Fair. 7 months later, he invited me to join his staff. No sooner had I moved to the Madison Avenue office than I had a request from two reporters at the Village Voice to be interviewed about Kozinski. After my experience with Barbara Gelb, I declined. But Locke, urged on by several of his senior editors, told me I really must speak to these men. This was serious stuff. So I spoke to one of them by phone, and it was crystal clear that all he wanted from me was the assurance that I played a big role in creating Kozinski's fiction. I told him what I had told Gelb, with the same result. I was not mentioned in the lengthy article by Jeffrey Stokes and Elliot Fremont Smith that appeared on June 22, 1982, titled Jerzy Kozinski's Tainted Words. If Gelb had produced the consummate puff piece, these men came up with the ultimate hatchet job, charging, "For almost 10 years now, Jerzy Kozinski has been treating his art as though it were just another commodity, a widget to be assembled by anonymous hired hands." Gelb had unwittingly provided the Voice writers with a second target, the New York Times itself, generally considered to be the temple of thorough, unbiased journalism. The last word. These downtown reporters were able to refer sneeringly to Gelb's article as the adulatory profile in the Times magazine, and they showed up her gushing appraisal of Kozinski with relish. They had interviewed, besides me, a number of Kozinski hires, who provided them with some eye-popping quotes. In the story, Richard Hayes, a former professor of drama at NYU and Berkeley who had worked on Passion Play, recalled, "I would say, instead, that I combed, filleted, elevated, or amplified his language." that I invested it with a certain Latinate style, which was sometimes more Hayes than Kaczynski. Here is an example of that style on page 35 of the hardcover. Perched on shoots of burdock, humiliated by the brawl of color that framed them, a flock of blackbirds, motionless, would watch Fabian's caravan sailing along channels and freshets of hazel and hornbeam, blackberry and sumac. Like a skiff bringing up the rear, a solitary leaf, its fretted veins a lair for the sun, would scud in his wake, gliding through the dappled air. John Hackett, a professor at the University of Texas, took offense at the suggestion that he was hired to proofread Cockpit. I was at that time an assistant professor of English and master of East College at Wesleyan. I was not the sort of person you would hire as a proofreader. Barbara McKay, an assistant director at the Denver Center for the Performing Arts, who had met Kaczynski when she was a graduate student at Yale and worked on 4 books with him, being there, the original edition of The Devil Tree, Cockpit, and Blind Date, explained, he would give me a sentence, talk philosophy, then come out with an idea that he wanted crystallized in a paragraph, a page, a chapter. The ideas were all his. I think he is a brilliant thinker, central in the world and in American culture, but the words were often mine. The term collaborator isn't right. I shouldn't say that anyway. All I did was put it into English. The voice writers had 2 other crimes to charge Kaczynski with. He probably wrote The Painted Bird in Polish, not English, and his nonfiction books might have been sponsored by the CIA. They interviewed a woman who said she had been asked by Kaczynski to translate the novel. Their account was vague at best. Early in 1973, one Helena Bastianello, a translator, wrote a letter to a New York Times reporter claiming that some years earlier she had answered an ad for a Polish-to-English translator placed by Kaczynski in the Saturday Review, and that he had wanted to hire her as the translator for The Painted Bird. The writers couldn't pin the story down, however. The Times had never followed up on it. Kaczynski's recollections in his interviews with them seemed to conflict with Bastianello's account, and the Saturday Review's records of the period were not sufficient to settle the issue. Neither could they prove that Kaczynski's 2 early nonfiction books had been fostered by the CIA, given that organization's well-known lack of transparency. Nevertheless, they ended the article on a tone that is both minatory and condescending. Jerzy Kaczynski has a lot of questions to answer, but though he promised effusively at the end of our second interview that he would answer follow-up queries left with his service and would even call us, he did neither. He is, I think, right to be worried, for unless he can come up with some answers to the obvious questions, it appears that he has betrayed his own talent along with his craft. Though his work for human rights as president of PEN is unassailable, the books grow worse and worse, the tales of his daring do more and more far-fetched. Finally, without at all forgiving him his lies, one feels sorry for Kaczynski. One wonders how sorry these 2 really felt for someone who had survived the Holocaust, won a National Book Award, written the Oscar-nominated screenplay for an award-winning movie, played a major role in another award-winning film, and taught at Wesleyan, Princeton, and Yale. In the end, it didn't matter. They had managed to get an angry quote out of their subject that would do him in. They put it in italics at the head of the article. Not a single comma, not a single word is not mine, and not the mere presence of the word, but the reasons why as well. This goes for manuscript, middle drafts, final draft, and every effing galley, first page proofs, second and third, hardcover editions and paperback editions. Jerzy Kaczynski, May 13th, 1982. 5. Stokes and Fremont Smith indicated that they planned to report further on the Kozinski matter, but they never did, presumably because they didn't have the goods to pursue their arguments to a reliable conclusion. But their loud cannon shot caused irreparable damage. Papers and magazines all over the globe felt obliged to join in the Kozinski debate, and that kept the accusations alive for years. The Voice reporters were roundly attacked by Kozinski's publishers, his fans, and his powerful friends. Even the Kozinski hires they had quoted, with one exception, Richard Hayes, complained that they had been misquoted or misinterpreted. It took 4.5 months for the New York Times to enter the battle, but when it did, on November 7, 1982, it was with a 6,400-word article on the front page of the Arts and Leisure section, the longest ever to run there. Originally assigned to Michiko Kakutani, a rising star at the paper, who soon declined the job, it appeared under the byline John Corey. Friends at the Times told me the piece was edited by Abe Rosenthal personally, and Arthur Gelb provided the title, 17 Years of Ideological Attack on a Cultural Target. Corey set out to dismiss the Voice reporters as mere perpetrators of old rumors about Kozinski planted in Poland after he published his two anti-communist books. The principal spokesman for those rumors was Wisław Górnicki, who in the 1960s had been a correspondent at the United Nations for the Polish Press Agency, and who then was a government advisor in Warsaw. In 1969, he wrote, "Jerzy Kozinski is the biggest literary fraud in the last several years. You cannot separate the writing of this man from his gigolo extravagances, his blackmails, and his cheats." He claimed that every emigre child knows that it is not Mr. Kozinski who writes so well in English, but a man called Peter Skinner, an authentic Englishman with an Oxford education who has been hired as a ghostwriter. The Voice reporters hadn't found or didn't quote Skinner, but the Times trumped them by doing both. Mr. Skinner, who lives in New York, worked for Mr. Kozinski as a part-time secretary in 1966. Mr. Skinner says he has never written any of Mr. Kozinski's books, either in whole or in part. Corey let Kozinski himself respond to the Voice's charge that the CIA apparently played a clandestine role in the publication of his first two books. "My anti-communism now becomes nothing but payment for a supposed association with the CIA. The core of my life, my spiritual life, is under attack. How can I prove I am not a member of the CIA? How can I actually prove I have written a book?" Corey managed to catch the Voice writers in a stupid mistake, which by coincidence arose out of their effort to discredit Barbara Gelb, who had written, "Kozinski's dreadful journey reached its climax when, aged 9, he was flung for punishment by sadistic peasants into a pond of human ordure that closed over his head. Something in his mind clicked off and he was struck mute." Jumping on that, the Voice responded, but in an interview in the current Penthouse, Kozinski says the key incident happened in June 1942, while I was serving in a mass as one of the altar boys. I was supposed to transfer the Bible from one side of the altar to another, but fell with it. I am convinced I lost my speech from the tension before the actual fall. Corey calmly asserted, "In fact, there is no discrepancy in the two accounts. In The Painted Bird, the boy is impressed into serving in the mass. He drops the Bible. The outraged peasants then fling him into a pit of human ordure." The Times called the very originality of the Voice article into question. Corey reported that Kozinski phoned Victor Novosky, the editor of The Nation, after he heard that magazine was preparing a story on him. "It was not true," Novosky told Corey, "but Kozinski's call aroused suspicion, so Novosky assigned a writer to investigate. When word of that got around, Novosky added, the nation got many calls. Among the callers, Mr. Novosky says, was Elliot Fremont Smith, who wanted to know what the nation had heard. Corey continued, the nation's story was dropped, Mr. Novosky says, when the writer assigned to do it lost interest. It would seem that Corey had settled the matter for good, but the length and tone of the Times article smacked of obvious overkill. The mud the voice had flung, verified or not, stuck. Kozinski ceased to be a superstar. He was now a writer permanently under suspicion. He spent nearly a decade out of the limelight. No longer even the bad boy who flaunted his familiarity with the city sex clubs because they had been closed by the AIDS epidemic. He and von Fraunhofer spent more and more time abroad. They were rarely mentioned in the gossip columns until February 15, 1987, when they were married in the apartment of the socialite Marion Javits, with only 28 friends in attendance, including the Rosenthals, the Gelbs, the Brzezinskis, and the Erdogans. Kozinski labored 5 years on his next book, which was postponed again and again. He also reportedly had a string of affairs with younger women. I was at a party one night when his name came up. I see that writer Jerzy Kozinski in my building every day, a young woman volunteered, adding, his girlfriend has the apartment below mine. 6. One day in 1985, Kozinski came to Vanity Fair to pitch an idea to the director of photography, Elizabeth Biondi, who asked me to sit in on their meeting. Kozinski had always identified himself as a photographer as well as a writer. In 1976, he said his friend Jacques Monod, the French Nobelist biochemist, learning that he had only a short time to live, had invited him to document his dying. Kozinski was proposing a photo essay of Monod's final stages. The Voice and Times articles were still much talked about in the publishing world. But since there was a third person with us that day, Kozinski and I avoided any mention of them. He was not the man I knew, however. The flair was gone, along with his biting sense of humor. That was the last time I saw him. Tina Brown, then Vanity Fair's editor, declined the photo essay, which was published in Esquire in March 1986. In 1988, Brown assigned Stephen Schiff to write a Kozinski profile for the June issue, pegged to the publication of his long-delayed novel, The Hermit of 69th Street. I remember lending Schiff my copy of The Painted Bird, but I recused myself from taking part in the article, which was called The Kozinski Conundrum. Kozinski gave Schiff a generous amount of time, but it seems as if in return, Schiff gave the novelist an easy ride. He repeated without question Kozinski's accounts of his awful childhood and his marriage to Mary Weir. When he asked Kozinski to explain how he got out of communist Poland to come to America, Kozinski snapped, I'm not going to tell you my life. No, I write fiction. I don't write biography. He brought that line of questioning to an end by saying, look, I came to America in such a fashion that the only way to secure the future of those who helped me was to maintain that sort of a fiction. Schiff devoted paragraphs to Hayes and the Latinate flourish he brought to Passion Play, only to conclude, the result was Kozinski's worst book ever, a two-headed monster born babbling infelicities. The story Novosky told Corey regarding the nation's part in the Kozinski War was filled out by Schiff. Then Elizabeth Pechoda, the literary editor of The Nation, received a letter from Kozinski about an article she'd written, and I realized that he didn't write English, and I started hearing these rumors, and I was going around saying, is it true? Is it true? And everybody said, of course it's true. Pechoda asked the Village Voice writer Jeffrey Stokes to look into the rumors, and then ceded the story to the Voice. whose Elliot Fremont Smith was already on the case. Pechota left The Nation to be one of Locke's senior editors at Vanity Fair. 7. The Hermit of 69th Street, The Working Papers of Norbert Kusky, is not for readers unfamiliar with Kosinski's life and work, because virtually every sentence is self-referential. The book is an encyclopedic document devoted to vindication and revenge. Kosinski is determined to prove to his enemies that he can produce a novel as original and erudite as Ulysses, in an English to match Joseph Conrad's. Even for readers who are familiar with his work, Hermit is therefore a fatiguing slog rather than the dazzling work of art he hoped it would be. The hero, Norbert Kusky, whose found papers have been entrusted by his estate to the writer Jerzy Kosinski, is also a Polish Jew, a survivor of the Holocaust, 55 years of age, with 8 novels and a screenplay behind him. He is hounded by 2 evil writers, trying to prove that he is a fraud, who gets an unconscionable amount of editorial help with his writing. The 529-page text is peppered with thousands of bold-faced quotes by famous individuals, beginning on the first page with one by Albert Einstein and concluding with one by Thomas Wolfe, one of many authors Kosinski cites as being charged with excessive assistance in their writing, among them Balzac, Hemingway, Fitzgerald, and James Fenimore Cooper. The book is further weighed down by more than 650 footnotes, ranging from the smart-alecky to the painfully pretentious. Much of the endless wordplay in the novel springs from a totemic use of the initials SS, or 2 words together starting with S and the number 69. A few examples. Well, literary comrades, the fact is that by now our tireless ghoul has hired some 68 different proofreaders and line and copy editors, most of them attractive females. Here, note Kosinski's pinpointing of the word limpid. Above all, says Kusky, what I want most as a writer is to be clear. In a momentary act of creative surrender, he spreads the test page number 69 on the table before her. Flag, or flog, if that's what turns you on, any word, any sentence, any description that doesn't make sense to you as a reader. I see one already. You spelled limpid as limpet, a nasty error. Clearly my typist minor typo, not mine. As one who majors in the Jewish narrative art, I make only major errors, he admits modestly. Here he obliquely attacks those who use his creative license against him. I do not find anything by Norbert Kusky. Is Kusky all sold out? Says Kusky. He's finished. Not just sold out, says Orlando. I doubt you'll find him or his books in any of our company stores. Pourquoi pas? Because he is no more listed either under fiction or nonfiction, that's why. What do you mean he is no more? Is he dead? Only as a writer. Haven't you read all these yellow rumors written about him in the yellow press? I don't read rumors. I read fiction, says Kusky. Then by all means, you must read these rumors. With that many real-life rumors floating about him, nobody is interested in his fiction. The novel ends with Kosky's death at the hands of 4 nameless men who pursue him in the dark, beat him senseless, then swing him by the hands and feet, hammock style, and throw him into New York's East River, the same way enraged peasants throw the boy hero of the painted bird into a pit of human excrement. Bantam, the publisher of Penpal, rejected the manuscript. It was published in 1988 by Seaver Books, a division of Henry Holt, to generally negative reviews. Years later, I was at a small dinner party with the imprint's founders, Richard and Jeanette Seaver, and I asked them what had gone wrong. Jeanette responded that everything would have been fine if she could have kept Kosinski from making changes on the final galleys. In the early morning hours of May 3, 1991, Kosinski, who was 57, swallowed a lethal dose of pills, got into his bathtub, and tied a plastic bag over his head. A suicide recommended by the Hemlock Society and described by him in his final novel. Von Fraunhofer, who was asleep in the next room, found him hours later, along with a note he had left. "I'm going to put myself to sleep now for a bit longer than usual. Call the time eternity." The reason he took his own life was variously explained in the press, from his long-standing heart problems to, according to his Polish friend Krzysztof Szaplinski in an interview with Vanity Fair's Anthony Hayden Guest, an increasing forgetfulness, and thus a fear of Alzheimer's. But many who knew him well, among them Abe Rosenthal, attributed it to his deep depression. 7, or rather 8. In March 1996, Dutton published Jerzy Kosinski, a biography by James Park Sloan, a novelist and professor of English at the University of Illinois in Chicago, who says he and his subject were friendly for 20 years. His acknowledgments reveal that he interviewed more than 100 people who knew Kosinski in Poland and the U.S. This article will be continued in the next installment. This program is intended for a blind and print-impaired audience. I'm Nancy Jones, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service and broadcasting from its studios in Raleigh, North Carolina. Vanity Fair Part A airs via special subchannel receiver on Saturday and Sunday nights at 11 o'clock Eastern Daylight Saving Time, streaming via the World Wide Web at those times. Vanity Fair Part B airs via special subchannel receiver on Monday and Tuesday nights at 11 o'clock Eastern Daylight Saving Time, streaming via the World Wide Web at those times. Both Parts A and B are available as a podcast. Opening and closing music by Calexico, interval selection by Mark Hoffman.